been arrested and put in the news in the city.
Okay, all right. But you know what that is? Now, Dostoevsky famously said that if you want to measure the level of civilization of a certain country, what would you do? Visit the person's head. Well, I spent a night there just one night. I never heard of just one night. Just one. Every American. And you get a feel for how dehumanizing, how subhuman people can be treated. It's something I recommend everyone to see just how bad it is. You know, I've been prison before, but never was treated quite that way. I'm probably running a little bit out of time here, but I do want to talk a little bit about, let me give some hope from, maybe I'll do it from Dan Berrigan. I told you about the hope he gives me by saying, hey, McGovern, you don't have to be successful. Just have to be faithful. So, you know, when people say, hey, great, what do you think you're doing there? Standing up and turning your back on Hillary Clinton. I have to tell you that something that happened in this campaign is kind of unfortunate. Now, when Bernie Sanders said, enough of your emails. I don't care about you. They have emails, right? Yeah. What else? Wow! What a neat gentleman. Yeah, he's going to talk about the issues. But I'm here to tell you, as an intelligent professional, that this was a serious crime. A serious crime that endangered just about everybody who had access to those emails, and guess how many people had access to those emails? Everybody! My colleague in the NSA, Tony Ray, it's as though we had a hole at the top of the State Department. And how do you suppose those real terrorists who did attack that was supposed to be a consulate, they call it a mission in Benghazi, okay? How did they find out that it was so lately defended? How did they know that there was a piece of cake to attack that thing? Well, I can't prove this, but if all the emails that went back and forth about should we strengthen the annex or should we not strengthen the annex, if they get hold of those emails, just as the Russians got hold of that famous intercepted message from Victoria Nuland, one of the protégés of Hillary Clinton, if they had access to that, they would have realized they could do that with virtual impunity, and so that's what they did. So these are not idle things, and I've come full circle now. I said, Bernie, you can be forgiven for being a gentleman, but nice guys don't win ball games, and he did this probably because he just didn't know. You should have asked us, huh? You should have said, look, I do care about your emails if they endanger U.S. lives. That would have made a point. Maybe it's not too late. I hope it's not too late. Now, what else? I want to kind of say that as I've gone through this transformation, started doing these things, I've learned a couple of things, and not only that you can't be preoccupied with whether this or that thing will be successful, another thing is you gather a small group of friends, people that you're really sympathetic with, okay, people you trust, and you meet with them every week. It's a big commitment, but you do it. Now, why do I say that? Because out of that synergy will come ideas that you never would have thought of by yourself. Never would have. And from that, you get not only support, choice support, but you get accountability. Now, if I say I'm going to go see my senator on Thursday, I know darn well that the following week my friends are going to ask me, well, how did I go with your senator on Thursday? In other words, you're held to what you say you're going to do, which is not something that's very frequent in wider circles. The other thing is that you have to keep your sense of humor. Now, I told you the story about the American in
just as I kind of pieced together, it's a little better. Just then, in came a jet jaw paradigm of an FBI inspector. Get a picture? Jet jaw paradigm, right? And he takes a look at it and he looks at the brother Phil, still in his clerical dress, and he says, "You again? I'm going to change my religion."
And then that compliment could come from my brother Phil.
Thank you.
You got to keep your sense of humor.
Yeah.
If you don't, you're dead. Dan, after the war, went on to other things, and one of the things he went on to was New Orleans. He was teaching at Jesuit High School there. And at one point, he got, as this is wont, he got all the kids in his class and several other classes out demonstrating for fair wages from the cafeteria workers in City Hall, right? And there's a big, there were hundreds of kids out there. And so the TV was on, and on live TV, a Jesuit high school graduate came by, and he looked at Dan Berrigan, and he said, "Oh, Berrigan, I am Jesuit educator. They never told me to do things like this. I'm going to speak to your superior." So, Dan said, "Well, you're locked. Believe me, my superior is ready." Was backing him and supporting him. And so they had a very short chat. And then the kids were led away to jail. And he said, "Hey, you have this!" Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of, you got to keep it light. Now, the other thing, which is not so light, is that Dan Berrigan ended up officiating at some liturgies in South Africa during apartheid. And again, as is Dan's wont, he didn't pull any punches. And he criticized apartheid up and down in this very way, fancy church. And so after it was all over, they came up to him, some of the faithful there. They said, "Now, Paul Bergen, if we do what you're suggesting we do, we're going to get arrested. And then what becomes of our children?" And then the Mississippi said, "Well, if you are not arrested, what then becomes of your children?" So, I want to leave you with questions. I have about 2 hours more of things to say here. And Santa Cruz, Ralph Beach, Marlene. And Code Pink. Thank God for Code Pink. As an aside, it's exactly 10 years since Code Pink got me a ticket to hear Bob Rumsfeld speak in Atlanta. And I was getting an award from the ACLU that same day, and somebody said, "Hey, Bob Rumsfeld's coming in early afternoon." And so they got me a ticket, cost me $70. Can you imagine? That's the hardest part. Anyhow, I had a chance to challenge him and prove that he was lying. Now, as I sat there preparing my own little speech for the evening, I was going over some of the lies that he had told. And so I had him dead to rights. You know, all I had to do was quote it back to himself. So I'm squirming. I had gotten there an hour earlier, and I put myself right next to the microphone, you know, except there was a designated first question on the way there. And I said, "Now, you want to get there, right?" "Yeah, you know, you've got that." It's a very hostile audience. It was a very wealthy, white, southern, defense-friendly, male audience. Average age, 70. Anyhow, I said, "Well, you know what? All of a sudden, the spirit came into my head and said, Ray, Cindy Sheehan, Anne Wright, with the abandoned, they would be having a conversation in their head about this. Get the hell out of the house. I don't know what you're doing." So I got my 9 minutes of fame upon him. The beauty of it was nothing else in the whole world happened that day. Also, this was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So, and CNN, C-SPAN had it live.
So without anything else to talk about, except I think one Kennedy brother went back into rehab, you can't get a half hour out of that. So I got interviewed on most of the channel and broadcast stations. One thing that I will tell you about that, though, is that as I was walking out of the auditorium, it was sort of like a fire trap, and it took a long time. And usually when you do something like that, you know, even though those of you have seen the thing and you're still on YouTube, usually when you do something like that, you have somebody come up to your phone, look around, make sure their husband isn't looking, and say, I know somebody needed to do that. Yeah, in vain, you know. Maybe I am vain, but I went around, you know.
And everybody tried to duck down.
So the phone rings, okay? And the
voice on the phone says, Mr. McGovern, this is Anderson Cooper.
I said, oh, hi, Anderson.
Hey, so you've been creating quite a stir down here. And I'd like to have you on my show tonight. I said, well, sure, sure. He said, well, first, I need to ask you a question. And I said, sure. And he said, well, now, weren't you, weren't you afraid? No, I was in shock, you know, it was a big deal. This guy got. I said, well, no, I wasn't afraid. I had briefed defense secretaries before. And then I thought, wait, this guy is heir to the Pendable fortune? This guy with three faces on CNN? He's asking me, wasn't I afraid? And so I'm going to tell him how that looks, isn't it? Actually, Anderson, let me be very frank with you. I've done my homework, and I knew that I've asked him these questions that you have to lie or retract what you lied before. And so, if you don't want to think about that, you do your homework, ask them real questions that your lies are real lies. Well, that's very well, but there are other people get to hear people like that.
But isn't that interesting? Wasn't I afraid? That's self-censorship. So the last thing I'll say, because my time is up, is that I've been in Washington now 53 years, so I've seen a lot of change. And some of you have heard me say this before, but that was probably 10 years ago, last time I was here. And it's even more true today. The biggest change that I've seen is that we no longer have in any real sense a free media. That is big. That could not be bigger. So if you agree, you can get the word out. You feel free that you can support people like Amy Goodman and all the good stations you have down here in California. Do it, and make sure your friends watch it, you know. I would like to just close with one short poem, because I think it's a kind of a challenge, and it's a kind of a good thing to follow. It's written by this fellow, Daniel Berrigan, whom, as you can tell, I'm very partial to. And it's not published. He wrote it for some dear friends, and the title is Some. Some stood up once and sat down. Some walked a mile and walked away. Some stood up twice, then sat down. I've had it, they said. Some walked 2 miles, then walked away. It's too much, they cried. Some stood and stood and stood. They were taken for fools. They were taken for getting taken in. Some walked and walked and walked. They walked the earth, they walked the waters, they walked the air. Why do you stand, they were asked, and why do you walk? Because of the children, they said, and because of the heart, and because of the bread. Because the cause is the heart's beat, and the children born, and the nursing bread. Now, I have to tell you that the risen bread means something special to me, but the concept is universal. How do I say this? Kurt Vonnegut, one of my favorite authors, a well-known humanist, atheist, agnostic, whatever you want, he was asked at one point, What do you think of Jesus of Nazareth? And he said, you know, I don't know if it's God's son or not, but, you know, if it weren't for the Sermon on the Mount, I think Jesus would be a cockroach. Now, I think to the degree we know about the Sermon on the Mount, we all share those sentiments. And we can write articles about it, or we can dream about it. What we need to do is act on it. I'll close with Cesar Chavez, another of my favorite prophets, who said, thanks very much for your speeches and for your op-eds. They're really great. But without action, nothing's going to happen. Okay? And you say, well, there aren't enough of us. He said, there are enough of us. But without action, nothing's going to happen. I'm preaching to the choir here. I'm also preaching to myself. Let's act before it's too late for our country. Thank you very much. He wrote a memo to the president on the 25th of January 2002, which said, now, Mr. President, we think that you have the authority to forget about the Geneva Conventions and treat the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, treat them, don't give them prisoner of war protection, you know. And then he thought, well, now I'm a lawyer, I have to hedge my bets. He said, now, you could be put up in charges to this president. And one of the penalties is death. But we think that even if a vindictive prosecutor, special prosecutor was named, that you still have the authority simply by saying, you're the president, you're the commander-in-chief, and so forth. So, Chai Yu is the epitome, in my view, of what's wrong with lawyers. Now, I'll just say one more thing. I said this earlier on the TV radio program. My dad was a lawyer. He was a professor of law at Fordham University for 30 years. He became chancellor of the Board of Regents of the State University of New York. And I used to watch him come home with sheaves of documents. They were all, not all, but many of them were reports of malpractice by doctors, malpractice by all manner of other professional classes. Finally, he said to him, Daddy, how come no lawyers? He says, oh, he said, you know, that's kind of a quirk. The lawyers somehow exempted themselves from this. So it's very odd, you're right, they should be included. But the only profession that we regents of the State University of New York have no purview over and no check on are the lawyers. And so who checks on the lawyers? I guess no. The local bar associations. And I guess John Yu is led off by the local bar association. You know, I think Shakespeare was right. I won't quote him about the lawyers. Two of my brothers are as well. And we have to hold it accountable, and there ain't no way to do it except to hold it accountable. So let's hold it on you accountable in a special way.
August 15th, we're going to do a citizen's arrest of John Yu. I hope it's worth it. And I actually don't like very many people to do a citizen's arrest, just for the asking people. So Greg wanted to take a few questions from the audience, and we could take just a few. So it has to be a real question, it has to be a short question. And I do want to leave a little time for you to buy a book, sign up on an email list. If you want to get your picture taken individually with President Obama, you have 250 days to Chef Guantanamo. Come back to the coaching table, I'll take the picture with your sign, and we'll post it on the website of Andy Worthington Post on time. And so, I'm going to let you choose if you want to choose the questions you want to take, but only three, I think three really short ones, please. Okay, great, sure.
Hi. Actually, I'm a lawyer, but so an announcement, actually, but it goes along with what you were talking about. It's an opportunity to actively vote and do an action. Every year, a group of us get together from various organizations, up from Western States Legal Foundation, and we have a rally at Livermore Lab to commemorate the U.S. bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This coming year is on August 9th. It's at 8 a.m. It's at Livermore Lab. Livermore Lab is happily chugging along, creating new nuclear weapons and improving the ones that we have, and we have to stop it. So, thank you.
$1 trillion to upgrade our current nuclear arsenal. Now, that's so obscene, you know. The ratings in this country are so great, and when there's really no threat, the Russians are trying to get us to negotiate on these things. And we should consider ourselves lucky that Putin is in power in Russia, and not some person with less sang-froid, with less patience, let me say, and I'll go on record as saying that. Next question. Yes, please, thank you. Yeah, the Panama Papers are very, very cut and dry. The real villain there is a fellow named Vladimirovich Putin, right? But somehow or other, he's not mentioned in the Panama Papers. A couple of his friends are, but the whole thing was blown out of proportion to blame Putin. Putin bad, Putin very bad. Putin by force sometimes. Putin has no shirt on. Putin. If Putin was seen walking on the bay here, the Chronicle would headline the next day, President of Russia clearly cannot swim because he was walking on the bay. So that was the main thing. The other thing is that the Americans don't have to use these offshore places. They've got Delaware, other state. And, you know, it would be interesting to look at these people. It hasn't come out yet, but several of the major funders of the Clinton Foundation are in those papers. But, you know, that's about the extent of my knowledge, and that's why, you know, so I forgot to talk about it. So, yeah, please. Did you hear that?
No.
To harness the energy of the Sanders Youth Brigade, so to speak, so that it's not over at the end of the election. Do I have that right? Yeah. Well, you know, I'm looking around here, and a lot of people have the same color hair I do. And I learned when I get beat up after I turned my back on Hillary Clinton, that when she got thousands of emails and telephone calls, it wasn't because of me, it was because Americans usually don't like old people getting beat up. Okay? I mean, young people and I got a common sense, you know, and I got young people, but old people like me, I was 71 at the time, they really don't like old people getting beat up. So, for most of you, you got a big advantage here. They're not going to play. They're not going to tell you. They're not going to break your arm. You may get treated to one evening in prison and hear what Dostoevsky has to say and to relate that to what our civilization has become. But put it into play. And I kid you not, because young people need to look up to somebody. Who are they going to look up to? I mean, the religious leadership, the institutional churches and synagogues and mosques, well, in this country, are acting just like their counterparts in Nazi Germany. They cannot find their voice. So, you know, that's bad news, in my view, but the good news is, there's us. And, you know, who is it? One of my favorite theologians said, you know, who shall ascend the mountain of God, who shall stand in God's holy place? There's only us. There never has been any other. And that's it, you know? It's us. But there is us. And that's why I suggested you turn around and look at each other. Just think, what strength you have. Not so much in numbers, but in the quality of your
of your strength and your intention to keep on struggling. Yes, please.
Yeah.
I'm going to be in Germany in early June, and then I'm going on to Russia with a delegation with some folks that are here. This is a citizen-to-citizen sort of thing developed by a person who's been doing this for almost 30 years now. I've been in Russia several times recently, but I hadn't really been there to travel around since 1972, if you can believe it. So I'm really looking forward to getting what the Germans call a Fingerspitzengefühl, through the little feel, a little view for what's going on there. You know, yes, please, in the back.
What a chief from CIA intelligence officer to an activist. How did that come about?
Okay, that's a question that I often get, and I have a disappointing answer because I didn't fall off my horse on the way to Damascus, so you know, it wasn't like, the short answer is there are two CIAs, one that Truman created, so there would be one analysis place with access to all information on a given issue or country, therefore central, right? And would report just to him, not to the State Department, not to the Pentagon. So the Pentagon told him that the Soviets were 10 feet tall, he had a place to go. He said, Pentagon's 10 feet tall, what do you guys think? And we told it to him straight. Now, for most of my career, that was 27 years, I had career protection for telling it straight. If I put a four-star general's nose out of joint, my superiors would defend me and not fire me. That's changed a lot, but not completely. And for all the bad stuff that happened over Iraq, where the intelligence was, I hope you know, not mistaken, but fraudulent. Deliberately fraudulent. And we have documentary proof of that, folks. Not only the British document, the Downing-Street papers, the intelligence was fixed around the policy. And this really sorrowful thing is that those are my friends. Those are the guys I left behind when I retired. So that's how bad it can be. Now, the good news, and this is really good news, and many of you probably don't know this because, some people think they can get educated by reading New York Times. Well, it's, you know, but back east, you know, that's what you do. I mean, my parents, did you not? They would not go to bed without having read the New York Times. And if they just decided, fell asleep, they put it in a special place where they had to finish it before they got the new one. My friends that I went to school with, you know, they think they know what's going on. So when I challenged General Jack Keane, who's a foreign alumnus, right? And I said, how can you say that the Iranians are this close to a nuclear weapon when the intelligence community has said that they stopped working on a nuclear weapon in 2003 in a non-regional war? How can you say that? And he says, this is a poor big meeting, our 50th reunion, his 45th. I have my own sources. I lost it. I said, that's a lie. The dean's, he's on the board of on the trustees now, which fell out of, you know, and stuff. So luckily, he just, you know, turned to the next questioner. But what am I telling you this for? My friends. Some of them I went to Port of Brooklyn. So 8 years, most of them 4 years. They're scratching their head. What's become of the government? My God. He's saying things that's not in the New York Times. And he's challenging a four-star general. How can he know as much as a four-star general? Yeah. Now, that's how bad it is. Back in New York, where everybody's so sophisticated, or under the Washington Post. Now, the good news is this.
When after Iraq, when the intelligence analysis part of the agency got prostituted, and that's the right word. These people came in and did what Bush and Cheney told them to do, okay? But I said, well, maybe there are less honest people left. And indeed, there were. And what happened was, after the debacle of intelligence on Iraq, someone, and I can't really tell who it was, said, you know, maybe we know that Bush and Cheney had their eyes set on Iran now before they leave office. Maybe we ought to get an honest intelligence assessment about Iran, because that would be
So they asked a fellow from the State Department. His name was Tom Finger. He was the head of intelligence. He was Assistant Secretary of State. He said, Tom, would you come in and come in an estimate, a national intelligence estimate, the ACME of analysis and the intelligence committee? Would you run an estimate on how close Iran is to nuclear weapons? He said, are you kidding? I was ready to rock some. I'm not going to touch it. No, I'm going to be in charge. And I can take some of you people from the State Department. Those people. So he said, okay, worked all year during 2007, had a little luck with some more information coming in, and they issued an estimate in November of 2007, which said, and I quote, Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003. And I'm not using the word on that. So that's 2007. Now, how do I know that that's what the spike in Cheney and Bush's plans to attack Iran? The answer to that is I've read George W. Bush's memoir. Now, he must have written these pages himself because he said, that estimate was an eyepopper. I have just said 3 weeks ago, that we're going to have a war in all three of us, which stopped Iran getting a nuclear weapon. This prevented me from using the military option. Great paragraph. Quote, well, how can I organize a strike on the nuclear facilities of a country that the intelligence community says has no active nuclear weapons program? Nuclear! That's pretty wrong! Okay? No, that didn't get the New York Times either. And, you know, one of the sorrowful parts of being a member is you have to read these memoirs. But there it is, he says it right there. So all I'm saying here is that there are enough honest people in the analysis part that did that and also refused to blame Russia and 12 Russian forces for the shootdown of Malaysian flight MH17. The best evidence suggests that it was part of the Ukrainians, that John Kerry was lying through his teeth. Well, John Kerry lied to us, and we got telemetry. We know exactly where the missile was fired from. We know exactly when it hit. That's when the plane went down. But you know what? When the Dutch were investigating, and one of the people asked John Kerry, well, let's see that information. Guess what? You can't find it. It must have been misfiled or something. He made it up. And if you remember, there was no intelligence assessment on that because my former friends refused. There was just a government assessment. A new genre. A new genre, which means that it was done by the hacks, the political hacks in the White House, to blame Putin. Putin bad, Putin very good bad. So, the operations folks, you know, that's a different story. When the CIA was created, in 1947, the folks came back from the war, the OSS, the people who overthrew governments, and the people who... Now, these were, I mean, I do not make lightly, these were very courageous, very imaginative people, dropping in behind the lines in Europe and Asia, you know, these are tough people. But when they came back, they said, well, no, you want us to, kind of like, should we go back to our law firms and corporations and academia, or no work for us here? Now, put yourself in 1947. Russians had already run over most of Eastern Europe, the KGB, the secret police, was the overthrowing governments. And so our leaders said, well, the Russians can overthrow governments. We better be able to overthrow governments, too. So the covert action people, now we don't say, I'm sorry, we don't say overthrow governments anymore. What do we say? Which is the regime change, okay? But they still couldn't figure out how to create a special agency for regime change or overthrow government. And so some idiot, and I use the word advisedly, said, oh, we're creating this analysis unit for President Truman, and it's going to have a secret compartment here because they're going to need to have some spies to collect information that's not available in other ways. So, hey, they'll all be secret. We'll take the overthrows of government, or regime changes, we'll put them together with the others, and we just want an happy family. A structural fault from the very beginning, a very noxious one, because how can you have Bill Casey running a war in Nicaragua
and being asked by Congress, the American people, is this a good idea, this war? You can't have the same person doing the same thing. So what happened was Bush took advantage of some very, oh gosh, what's the adjective? Well, George Tenet wanted to blend in and be part of the team, and he corrupted the whole agency, and Dick Cheney told them all what to do. They made up this stuff about Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. The way this comes into play today, and the reason that Scott Ritter and I did a teach in New York 2 days before the primary, because we both told Hillary Clinton that there were no weapons of mass destruction before she voted for the war. Now, Scott Ritter, he was a constituent. He lives near Albany, right? He was the chief Iraq, the UN Iraq inspection guy, right? So he came down to New York, or couldn't get in an office there. I went down to Washington. He just said, look, you know, I'm talking to senators. I'd like to see my own senator, Hillary Clinton. Couldn't get in the door. Why? Because she knew what he was going to say, and she wanted us to be really tough, right? So that she could get her turn to be president of the United States. Well, that's the kind of person you're talking about here. The incredibly cynical, incredibly politically motivated, and it lost her the nomination 8 years ago. I don't know what's going to happen now, but I think California is key, and if I could put a little plug in here, we did our best in New York. We went up there, and we had this teacher at the Judson Memorial Church, and we went for 3 hours going in. We got a no media except what you see on my website or on other things. So it's a real challenge, but if you get out there and tell all your friends, you know, what this is like for the Democratic primary, for God's sake, do it. Because Californians are only hope for it now, as I see it. And I think that I never thought that I would be in a position at this point in this election cycle where it's very enthusiastic about a possible candidate. And to see him being dissed in the media and being overridden by people who don't know what's going on is really hard. Yes?
The question I have is, what do you think might happen with the email? Is there any chance that you decide?
Okay. The question is, what's going to happen with the email thing? I guess I mentioned this already, but I did an article. See, being part of this Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity group, it's not really an institution, it's a movement, right? We got about 50 people on any given product. We usually have 7 or 8 take the lead. I asked Bill Binney from NSA, okay, a whistleblower, who was the chief technology director when he left after 9/11. I asked Matthew Poe, who was a Marine in Iraq, and then a very high State Department official in Afghanistan, and who else did I? Oh, yes, Scott Ritter. For you, what did I look at? You know, what damage could this do if her emails got out with other people? And then you can just look it up on my website, raymondgovern.com. It's a very, very serious matter. And the one I did yesterday, which you'll see tomorrow, if you look, takes it the next step. It says, well, what if, you know, how was it that those people with Big Bounty, you know, felt so confident that they could shoot the hell out of that annex, or shoot the hell out of the mission, or the consulate, whatever they call it there, without anybody to defend it, because they knew there was no people there to defend it. Now, there are other ways they could have done that, but what I'm saying is that the emails that were interceptable by everybody was one way they could. And when I talk about the example that she gives, or gave, you know, Victoria Nuland, some of you know, is the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs. Well, she decided, well, she just talked on the open telephone with our ambassador in Kiev, and she says, you know, yes, he's our guy, and let's go, and the others wait in the wings, and we've got this pretty much glued down, And so, you know, just tell them to talk to each other, but yes, he's got the experience with respect to the central bank. He knows what kind of austerity measures are going to be necessary. Yes, it's the guy. Yeah. Somebody, maybe it was the Russians, somebody intercepted that open telephone call and put it on YouTube on the 4th of February.
Now they say, the revolution will not be televised.
Well, this coup was utilized, okay? And we got it. And you know, in the old days, before we did regime change, and when we worked with Tony Benton, you know, it used to sort of disqualify the fellow that we wanted to make the prime minister. You know, if his name got in the press like 2 weeks ahead, you know, it would say, Charlie, sorry about that, but we can't really put you in charge of this coup now because your name is up. Well, there's no decent respect for the opinions of mankind anymore, folks. I wake up on the 23rd of February, turn the radio on, and I find that, yes, Yatsenyuk is going to be the Prime Minister of Ukraine, and the U.S. government has already recognized it in record time. And remarkable. Yikes! It's yikes! Now, as you know, 2 weeks ago, Yats has destroyed, he's gone now, he's destroyed the economy, and now, you know, the EU or somebody's got to pull up those things out of the fire. So, now let me just finish here, and thanks for your patience for those of you stuck around. I know this has been a wonderful evening for me, but I'd like to talk more than you have. I want to finish with a quotation from Martin Luther King Jr. I was thinking about this as I came down Martin Luther King Street or Avenue. It's from that incredible piece of American literature, The Letter from the Birmingham City Jail, and it talks about a boil. Now, I started this back on time, what boils are like when you're an adolescent and all that, and the D. Benjamin said, that's enough sharing, Ray, that's too much sharing. Well, you know what a boil is like, right? This is what Martin King says, like a boil that can never be healed unless it is, while it is still covered up, but must be opened with all its pus flowing ugliness to the natural medicines of air and light. So too injustice, so too violence must be exposed with all the friction its exposure creates.